how do you increase revenue from a wholesale standpoint? How do you maintain and increase revenue from a retail standpoint, especially if you're not growing that retail footprint? How do you maintain revenue with falling prices? How do you speak to your customer base and understand your customer base and maintain them and then grow that?
This is The Dime. Dive into the cannabis and hemp industry through trends, insights, predictions, and tangents.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of The Dime. I'm Brian Fields. With me, as always, is Kellen Finney. And this week, we've got a very special guest, Gabe Mendoza, EVP of Revenue at Forefront Ventures. Gabe, thanks for taking time. How are you doing today?
Happy to be here. Negative 14 degrees in Chicago, so I'm happy to be inside with you guys today. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Kellen, how are you doing?
Doing really well. Really excited to talk to Gabe, get the whole backstory on Forefront, you know, everything they're doing. It's nice to have someone who would love to live and loves the West Coast, you know, Brian?
You're absolutely right about that. And there's no doubt that loving to live on the West Coast is something, but I know something that Gabe loves more than wanting to live on the West Coast, and that's his mom. And I think just East Coast, West Coast battle. Gabe, if you had a loyalty to either the weather or to your mom, which one would you choose?
Well, now that you brought my mom into this, I guess I have to say East Coast. Yeah, my mom was born in Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy, and I've opened up a handful of dispensaries on the East Coast. So if I had to choose, mom, I'm choosing you, East Coast.
That's fair.
So, Gabe, for our listeners unfamiliar about you, give a little background about yourself and how you got into the cannabis space.
Yeah, so I entered into the industry in 2013 when Illinois was just passing its medical law. I got together with a team and applied for and won both a dispensary and a cultivation license here in the state, and very fortunate to do that. And I was then able to parlay that into selling the controlling interest to Forefront Ventures, who then took me along this magical ride where I opened up 14 dispensaries in 7 different states. We obviously went public, and the rest is kind of history. And so it's been a long ride with plenty of experience. And it started here in Illinois, which is where I'm based. And it has taken me all over the country, including Arkansas. And that's an interesting story I'll tell you guys either now or later.
Yeah, I think that might be the first time that state's been dropped in this podcast. So I'd be curious to know, A, how you got there, and then we can dive deeper into Forefront's kind of origin.
So we were the third dispensary in Arkansas to be open, and it was in a little town called Clinton, Arkansas. And it was a dry county, except for us and the restaurant that served alcohol right next to it. And we had open interviews and spent 12 hours in the local gymnasium interviewing every single person seemingly that town had. Even the head of zoning and planning, he sat down in front of us and I said, buddy, you've got to approve our zoning. You can't be an employee here. You've got to go approve our zoning, man. And so that was it was amazing how quickly we got that thing open. We got it open in 3 months. Arkansas was really amenable, but just interviewing an entire town over 12 hours showed you know, how much people really love cannabis, how much they believe in this, and how much they wanted to be a part of the industry. So it was very humbling, but man, that was a long day.
So there was excitement, you're saying, from the people in that town to be a part of this, because one could envision it could be quite the opposite, right? Where the protesters outside saying, absolutely not. This is a dry county. This is a dry town. Like, this doesn't happen here.
Very surprised at the outcome. You know, when you look in Arkansas, it actually has a really rich underground growing history. And so there was a lot of people that had come from that, and they wanted to just be a part of something legal and in the open. And we were able to hire a really kick-ass team, and they were able to just really crush it. And being obviously first mover in Arkansas helped as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go back to Forefront, right? One of the oldest, if not the oldest. I'm not so familiar with some of the history here because we're predating me for sure. When did Forefront get started? And take us through kind of the evolution of it from the early days to kind of where we are now.
Yeah, so I think that's one of our really unique differentiators here is that Forefront started in 2011. It started as a application writing consultancy where we were helping people all over the country write their applications. We had developed a really robust set of SOPs from Harborside. We partnered with Harborside, which for many of the listeners who know that it was founded in Oakland and was one of the first really legitimate dispensary chains. And so we worked with them to create these SOPs, and we took these SOPs and we started to apply and win these licenses. once we had won about 60 of these, we started to ask ourselves, well, hey, we're pretty good at this. Why don't we go ahead and do this ourselves? And so that's what we did. And we started by winning and acquiring licenses in Illinois. And then we took that roadshow and we went into Pennsylvania. We went into Massachusetts. We acquired stuff in Arizona, Arkansas, Michigan. And so it really started in 2011. We were able to take that and parlay that into actually opening and running our own licenses. And the amount of time that we spent in this industry has helped us really hone in what we think on the industry and has helped us evolve because, you know, what we thought in 2011 and what is the reality in 2024, quite different, right? And so it's been a blessing to be able to be around for this long.
So, I mean, that sounds like a very sophisticated team in terms of the tasks that you guys were undertaking in the early days. And so was that one of like the biggest motivating factors for you kind of jumping on board with 4Front when you did sell your cannabis assets at the time? Was, can you kind of talk us through what actually was the motivating factor for you to jump onto their ship?
Yeah, I mean, when you looked at their portfolio and looked at what they had helped to do, and when I was in Illinois looking at the options for us, they had helped win a handful of licenses in Illinois. And so when I was looking to find a strategic partner, I could not have found someone better than them. Not to mention they had the capital to back this thing up, which was huge, right? I mean, when we started, it was a, hey, let's cobble together some money from our local friends and family to apply for this. And we had, you know, we had no idea the amount of capital intensivity that this would be. And so I was so grateful that we had someone that had the experience and had the capital to get us through to the end.
Is it just wild thinking back on it when you first got started in the space and then like just everything that you've had to go through just to get to that moment? Because I could see in your face like the feelings that and the emotion that came rushing back when you thought about that.
It is, you know, when we first applied, right? I mean, there was no guarantee that we were going to win anything, right? So I quit my full-time job to do this and to get paid significantly less to just work my butt off to try to apply for these things. And when we won, then it was like, well, oh, shit, what's next? What do you even value something at this at, right? There's no comparables for this. It's like, okay, we won a license. What are we going to value this thing at? And it was me and my CEO and one other individual. And we just figured this thing out from the ground up. And we were very proud of what we had built, right? I mean, we found these locations and we started to build these things out. And then once you're cutting $500,000 checks to your lawyers and you're like, what is happening here? Where's all the money going? You start to realize, okay, we're going to need to really get even more sophisticated on this because this is something that is way more costly and way more time consuming than we ever thought. It took us a year to get open our first dispensary through the zoning process in Chicago, because every time we would look, there would be groups of individuals who would come in busloads to City Hall and say, not in my backyard, we're okay with this. And of course they had actual political aspirations against the aldermen, we call them aldermen, in our areas. And so there was so many different layers of complexity to this that we were just like, hey, we just wanted to open up a dispensary and a cultivation center and help as many people as possible. How are we getting involved in the city politics where it's taking us a year and tens of thousands of dollars just to find a location? So yeah, there's a rich history that comes with being in the industry for this long.
And those are my favorite points, right? Because you won the license and now comes the actual hardest part, which is like, there's no roadmap. There is no really Googling for like, okay, like how to open a dispensary. And if there is, it's probably not applicable for like what you're trying to accomplish, given all these challenges. And then you have these small fun details, right? Where people are busloading in to dispute like where you can get zoned, which is just, again, not something I bet you processed internally when you wanted to get started and then apply for that license.
Never, right? I mean, it has been something. I mean, the ability to just absorb and learn from these lessons is paramount, right? Because you do not want to have to footfall again and again and again. And that's something that, again, is very unique to us because of our longevity here. We've been able to take these things and really understand them and take what we've learned and apply it to new states and apply it to new municipalities so that we don't make these same mistakes.
I love it. So let's get overall top level assets so people can see like 4Front, this is where they're positioned, this is where their assets are. Give us just a rough breakdown of those.
Yep. So we've got a we have cultivation in Washington. You can't be vertical in the state of Washington. So Washington was really our bread and butter, where we started to understand our cultivation processes, where we had to understand, because of the market and how highly competitive it is, that you need to understand cost structure. You need to be able to be competitive from a pricing standpoint, while also maintaining quality and branding as well. So Washington is where we started from our cultivation side. In Illinois, we have two retail licenses. We have a third, fourth, and fifth on the way. And I can talk to you more about that. But we're starting construction on our third one next week. And we have a cultivation center right now in Illinois. It's on the smaller side. So we're in the process right now. We're moving by the end of this year, even before the end. We're going to be inside of a new facility, which is going to be 250,000 square feet, 40,000 square feet of canopy, which is a 5X of our current canopy. And so we're really digging deep into Illinois, because we have the ability to scale here. And so transferring to Massachusetts, we've got three dispensaries in Massachusetts. We also have three Grove processing facilities. So that's a max. We've maxed out in Massachusetts. We're really excited about the locations that we have. We continue to see customer growth, and even the price compression that you're experiencing in Massachusetts, we're actually not experiencing that as much because of the product differentiation that we have. People are buying more from us. And so I think that's kind of bucking the trend with a lot of the other state stores in Massachusetts. So Washington, Illinois, Massachusetts.
And so across those three states, do you guys try to like maintain similar product SKUs? Like kind of talk us through how you maintain your guys' product portfolio in each state. And if it's like, hey, Illinois, we're vertically integrated, we have more room to grow, we're trying more new products, kind of like talk us through how all of that works.
Yeah. So in Illinois, where we have been only flower in Illinois up until this point, because we didn't want to spend CapEx on equipment that wasn't going to be scalable for the big grow. So essentially we're only doing flower, but when we grow into Matteson, which is where the location is going to be, we are going to bring our full portfolio, which is going to be all of the brands that we've created in Washington, which is essentially what we do. So we've created these brands in Washington. We've tested them out. We understand what demographics they speak to. And then we launch them into Massachusetts and we launch them into Illinois. And so that's kind of the process, if you will, where we test these things in Washington. Because of its high level of competition, it helps us really understand what's going to work and what's not. Obviously, the Washington consumer and the Illinois consumer and the Massachusetts consumer are different, but it does help us to get a sense of what's going to work and at what price is it going to work. And so that's when we bring them into states like Illinois and Massachusetts.
Is there products like in Washington where you're like, hey, this was targeted towards like an older population, we launched it here. Yeah, there's not a ton of older demographic individuals living in this geographic region, but here in Massachusetts at this dispensary, there is. Do you guys try to play those kind of games with certain products?
Oh, for sure. I mean, when we create a product, we have a certain customer in mind, a certain demographic in mind. And so when we bring it to a state, we have that same customer in mind. It's not like we take a highly medical product from Washington and try to bring it to a Massachusetts or an Illinois as a recreational product. So it helps us to understand, based on what's working in Washington and the demographic that it's fitting there, where we're going to slot it into Illinois and Massachusetts. And because we have so many brands in Washington, we can take a look at where the gaps are in Illinois and where the gaps are in Massachusetts and say, hey, we need this market does not have an infused pre-roll that they need, right? And so let's bring this from Washington, let's bring it into Illinois, let's bring it into Massachusetts. And so having that expanded breadth of products allows us to kind of pick and choose what we want to bring in and where, based on the gaps that we have.
And that's an experience kind of mindset, right? Like that is one from recognizing different variations in states and recognizing that there are different product portfolio mixtures, but also at the same time, probably understanding that we'd rather products like failure, we want to minimize the failure, and the upside aspect, we'd rather mitigate that and say, okay, this is where we want to play. And if we can invest in new product portfolio, given this kind of mix in the gap, that's probably where the bigger upside and the reach could be in new markets, right?
Huge. I mean, efficiency is so important, especially now in a capital constrained environment. You can't just be shotgun approaching putting all of your products in and hoping for the best. I mean, you really have to be as targeted with your cash as possible, because if you're going to launch 10 different brands and hope that, you know, that some of them make it and some of them don't, you're just losing money on packaging. You're losing money on a lot of the fixed costs that go into that. So we really try to be deliberate into what we're introducing into the market, because there's only so much cash to go around, right? I mean, we are stewards of our company's cash.
Do you guys get to use the same packaging in every state and just like make slight changes to it? Like, is that something that you can do with like stickers? Because I know that's a pain in the ass. I've heard.
It's a pain in the ass. It is. It's definitely a pain in the ass. Most of the time, I mean, the child-resistant packaging you can use, but what gets different is the labels, yeah, right? So I can take like a Island, which is one of our products, an Island label from Illinois, and put it onto Massachusetts, unless, like you said, you're ready to re-sticker a bunch of different things that say Massachusetts on it, which is just, I would say, a labor of love, but I'd be lying.
And there's nothing better than getting a, let's say, a Massachusetts labeled product in a different state, and someone's like, well,
there's nothing better than pulling the sticker back and seeing that it says Massachusetts on it when you're in Illinois. So yeah, you don't want to do that.
I think that only happens in New York with California products.
That may have happened. I'm not going to confirm or deny it, but at the end of the day, like, we could be in California or we could be in New York. It's up to you to decide. So when we're 5X-ing our facility in Matteson, is that a strategic conversation internally? Because that is not a small jump. That is a massive jump forward. Is that an internal one saying, this is where we want to double down and we think there's big opportunity still in this state?
Absolutely. I mean, it is the most important decision that our company has made, and that's going to be the most important decision of 2024, right? I mean, it's no small... when you walk into this new facility and you hear it's so massive, you hear the echoing of your voice on these walls, the responsibility really hits you right in the face, right? I mean, you have a massive facility that you need to be able to operationalize, and you have to be thinking about it every single day, because every day that it comes closer to coming to fruition is a day that you have to execute. You have to be extremely intentional on what it is that you're doing. So yeah, that's the biggest thing for us in our portfolio for 2024, is getting this thing up and operational. We have done a really good job on our wholesale to date in Illinois, where we have, I think it's like, we've increased wholesale year over year, we've tripled it from 23 to 22, and in an attempt to really get our feelers out into every single dispensary that we can, so that people can understand who we are, people can get to know us, people can understand our processes, so that when we come to them with a full suite of products, they're not just going to say, hey, who the heck are you guys? So that's been something that we've really put an emphasis on in 2023, was making sure that we hit wholesale really hard in Illinois. And I'm happy to say that, you know, tripling it was no small feat.
Hopefully this new facility can then triple it again. And so when you guys are building out this facility, is it like a collaborative effort with your cultivation teams on both sides of the coast and everyone kind of throwing their two cents in? Or did you guys like be like, okay, this is our team for this facility right now, and they can reach out if they have questions? Like, how does that whole organizational structure look in terms of launching something massive like that?
It's a great question. So we have so much institutional knowledge spread out throughout the country, right? Yeah. So it behooves us to lean on them. Obviously, we have leads, right? We have individuals who are taking point on this, yeah, and who will be making these decisions ultimately. But we incorporate all of our strategic assets, all of the brain trust, if you will, to say, okay, hey, look, here's what I know works. Here's what we've seen work in Washington. Here's what we've seen work in Massachusetts. Here's what we've seen work in Illinois, which obviously is extremely important, right? Although our scale is small currently in Illinois, they have the most accurate information as to what plants do given the environment outside in the Illinois environment. I mean, in the summers, it gets really hot and it's humid. In the winters, it is super cold and dry. And so we have to be able to leverage the intimate understandings from everyone to make this thing work, because not one person's going to have the answer for all of it.
No, and when you get to a scale like that, it's not as easy as just hiring 5x amount of people. You've got to have other tools and automations in place. So are there additional, let's say, assets that are being built into that facility in order to allow it to scale and to be able to grow the type of canopy that you're looking to?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that we did when we exited California was bring all of our machinery from California to the Illinois facility so that we could hit the ground running there. And there is, I mean, we are going to be extremely automated, is going to be very much a manufacturing process when you agricultural manufacturing, when you look at Matteson in 12 months from now. And so, yeah, it is, you can't just like, and that's one of the reasons why we decided not to invest in a kitchen or a processing lab in Illinois with the scale that we had, because you're just going to have to either sell that thing or it's going to collect dust, because you're not going to be able to create scale with a 40,000 square foot total facility and try to put stuff into that when you're going into a 250,000 square foot facility.
Were there specific strains that you guys like had picked out when you went into the facility? You're like, these are the ones that we're growing. Kind of talk us through that whole like pheno hunt, if you will.
And that's something that we have done really well in, which is pheno hunt. So yes, we have a list of strains that we are going to grow inside of that facility. And we have a list of strains that we are going to have specifically dedicated to our retail stores initially, so that we can really generate that buzz and that unique selling prop for those strains. But one of the things, and one of the brands that I'm most excited about that's coming out of our cultivation facilities in both Illinois, Massachusetts, and Washington is a brand called The Hunt. And it's an homage essentially to a pheno hunt. And we are essentially taking a bottoms up approach where we're listening to our cultivators and they're saying, hey, look, we have these phenos that we're growing, that we're testing out. Why aren't we bagging these things and selling them? Because there's good quality product here. And so we started to actually create a product around that, a brand around that. And we have, we've launched it in Illinois and Massachusetts, and it's doing really well, right? I mean, it's like small batch essentially, where it's limited runs. The consumer doesn't know if they're going to get it again or not, because sometimes, although it hits high THC or it's a high yielder, maybe it takes too long, or maybe the testing on it is coming back a little bit. It's a little bit tricky for testing. And so it's kind of an homage to back when you had your local drug dealer and you didn't know that what the weed was, but you were excited because you know that this guy grew good stuff, right? And so it's basically like creating this desire to look to see what is Forefront created this week or this month that I can consume that may not be back again. And so that has been huge for us. And we're taking all those phenos and we're taking the best of the best and we're bringing them into the Matteson facility.
I love it. It's like a combination of exclusivity, but you're also giving the customer the urgency and also allows your team to kind of experiment a little bit. But the one part that I want to push back on is you are an MSO, correct?
Yes.
So you're growing, call it high quality flower also?
It is. And you know what? This is one of the things that comes with the longevity that I'm speaking of, right? Because it's like, in 2011, when we first started, I mean, even a little bit later than that, we had, you know, our cultivation processes in Washington was like, okay, low cost production. Let's focus maniacally on that. But when you only look at that, what happens is quality starts to take a second seat. And that was something that about 2 years ago, we made a really seismic shift, which was that we can grow the lowest priced weed, but if people don't want to smoke it, who the hell cares, right? And so we had a massive shift to, okay, we need to re-look at how we're curing. We need to look at harvest. We need to look at drying. We need to understand how this affects the final product and do whatever it takes to understand how you make the product better. And so, yeah, we at first, we were just like low quality, or low price, whatever quality. And we had a come to Jesus moment about 2 years ago where it's like, this is not the way to scale. And this is not how it's going to look at the end of the day, because at the end of the day, eventually everyone's going to get down to low cost. And then it's going to be, well, I'm going to pick what's the lowest cost and the best quality. And if you're not there, and if you haven't had those tried and true tribulations to understand how you get there, you're going to be screwed.
How do you guys balance maintaining that quality with automation? Is that like a labor of love where it's like trial and error, right? Because like people think automation, you know, it's hard to like correlate those
yeah.
two. So like, what was that That's balance?
The reality now is that with technology developing the way it is, you're able to not just destroy the bud. You know, I mean, when at first, when we were taking these things and we don't hand trim, we machine trim. But at first we had these machines that were just destroying the wheat, right? I mean, it was taking the trichomes right off. It looked like it was just like brown and just like sticky and not in a good way. But you know, with the advent of technology, you're actually able to get these things where they look and they smoke well, you're not knocking the trikes off, and you're actually able to maintain a high tack. And then with same concept with the cure and the dry, we're now able to reabsorb those terps, and they're able to, we're not rushing them out the door, right? So yes, yeah, some of it is timing, right? Is taking the time it takes to make the product good. And some of it's just the development of technologies has allowed us to create a higher quality product with the same cost saving structures that we've come to really lean on.
And I think the biggest benefit is that the consumer now gets a product at likely a lower cost because it costs your team less money to produce that high end product.
Exactly right. I mean, that's the goal, right? I mean, there is this perfect equilibrium point where it's the right price at the right quality. And that's what we're always striving for now. And it is a real focus. And that has enlivened our grow team. You know, I mean, our cultivation team and our cultivators are so excited to be able to be working with a company that's actually gives a shit about the quality, right? And that allows us to retain talent, that allows us to inspire innovative ways to still maintain our cost structures, but to think on quality, right? When you give people this ability to be creative and the backing that we are standing by the quality of our product, it really opens people's minds and it opens people's eyes. And that's been huge for us. We've been able to retain really top quality talent because we've committed to this.
Do you think product innovation comes from the bottom up instead of the top down?
I think that it depends on who's at the top, right? I think that the way that we do it is we know what we don't know. We know that at the executive level, we can run an efficient operation. We have cost structures in place, but are we heads down in the weeds at the same level as our dispensary employees or our cultivation employees who are looking at this and talking about this every single day? You know, I think that there's an argument to be made that they're talking about this every single day. They're in the facilities every single day. And so to not listen to them would be foolish. So we have every quarter, we have a all hands where we bring the employees together and we talk about product innovation. And then we create a roadmap based on what those are. And some of those ideas make it right. The Hunt is a perfect example of that. And some of them don't. Right. And so we aren't cocky enough to think that we've got all the answers. We know that this is a team effort. And so we lean on them.
During those all hands meetings, is it kind of like someone's walking around with a notepad, like, oh, that's a good idea. Oh, that's a good idea. Like, how does that whole like process like transpire?
Yes. So it's virtual because you've got people all over. But what happened is, yeah, we've got individuals that we obviously prep them and say, hey, come prepared. Yeah. Talk, right? Come prepared with ideas. Don't just come and sit here to listen. Please do have an idea or two and don't be afraid to share them. And it's kind of good because I like to start by saying ridiculous ideas. So people kind of get comfortable and they're like, okay, well, my idea is not going to be as ridiculous as that. Let me go ahead and say something, because you really do need those people who work their butts off, but might be a little bit afraid to speak on these things to get comfortable. And then, yeah, we have a note taker, and that individual creates a project plan with all these different ideas. And we then say, okay, this one we're going to do this year. This one we're going to table for maybe next year when we open up Matson. And it's a collaborative thing. It's a beautiful thing. But yeah, someone needs to be there taking notes.
I'm sure there's so many great ideas that come out, and that's such a smart concept to be applied. It seems like something like what Facebook did, where they adapted like the news feed, right? It came from one of those hack events. I want to know, what was one of the crazy ideas that you threw out there? You intentionally said, all right, I'm just going to anchor out here. Give us an example of one of those crazy ideas.
Okay. So here's a crazy idea that I have. And I do think that this will come to fruition,
I love it.
But it is. So I would love a, and I don't exactly know how this is going to happen biologically, but there's got to be a way to measure your endocannabinoid system, see where you're deficient in terms of terpenes and cannabinoids, and be able to then dial up something that would get you that exact mix of full spectrum cannabinoids and terpenes that allows you to get that homeostasis level where, because there's like a threshold where if you consume too much cannabis, then it's got a negative effect on you, right? And so we need to find that equilibrium point where individuals can consume the perfect amount, they're better human beings for it, and they can go about their day. And so, you know, you got to think about random weird things like that to get people kind of juiced up.
I think it's possible, though. You know, it's just a wearable, and someone's just got to build the calibration model to correlate the endocannabinoids in your blood to specific levels. You know, any entrepreneurs out there, right?
Like, yeah,
Gabe's like, we need to hire a team of world class scientists to do data studies on every single person.
We're starting a clinical. We're going to need to do blood work. So
we'll start it at 50 million. Is
yeah, exactly.
We're going to change the industry.
We'll hit the market by 2045. So I want to get into some of the experience and then specifically EVP of revenue, because I'm really fascinated by your title. So my understanding is you've launched 14 dispensaries, 3 cultivation centers in 7 different states.
That's right.
Is there a certain state that has been more problematic than others? And then has been on the other side, has there been one state you think is your favorite state and has been the, let's call it smoothest?
Yeah, no, I mean, so Massachusetts was a very difficult state from a regulatory standpoint because the local municipalities in Massachusetts really had problems with allowing for cannabis to be in their little neighborhoods. And so it took me 3 years to get the Brookline, Massachusetts dispensary open. 3 years. 3 years. And so that has been a really difficult state to operate in. Now that we're open and running, you know, it's great. And I think that you're starting to see, if you know anything about what's happening with the CCC in Massachusetts, it's like a dumpster fire over there. And so, God, I hope that doesn't get me in trouble with the CCC, but
I don't think they're big listeners.
It's very old school political there. And not to say that Illinois is not, but there was a lot of folks that said, you know, NIMBY's not in my backyard. We're not going to have this. I remember we had opened up a dispensary in Cambridge, right? In Harvard Square. And we were operating it. And the sheriff came and closed us down. And we reopened because there was no reason why the local municipality was trying to revoke our permit. And we had a lawyer who was working for us and called us up and said, hey, guys, I was just working on another case and the local PD was telling me how they were going to raid a cannabis dispensary in Cambridge. And I asked them who it was. And it's you guys. So you guys cannot, and this was, I mean, this was 2018, 2017. It wasn't like this was in the beginning stages. I mean, they were literally setting up to raid us because we were open with the proper permits, and this Cambridge didn't want to give it to us, or they wanted to revoke it so that they could hold off. And I think just last year they finally reissued that permit, you know, 5 odd years or whatever years later. But it's just like, you're gonna do what? And I remember back in 2011, we actually would do raid training for our clients. Like, okay, if a raid happens, this is what you do. You know, this is how you operate. Do not do this. Please, you know, comply. And I just, you know, 2018, 2017, I just didn't expect that. So Massachusetts has been incredibly difficult, but thankfully we're open and we're maxed out there. So they can't give us too much shit. Illinois has been, I mean, in my opinion, the level of price compression here, the amount of limited licenses, obviously I'm biased, right? But the amount of limited licenses has really helped us and helped the industry, right? I mean, you're looking to states like next door, like Michigan, where they've unloaded an unlimited amount of licenses, essentially, if the municipality wants it. And yes, their top line revenue is amazing, right? It's I think even bigger than Illinois. But when you look at the success rate of these dispensaries and what they're selling their products for and the cost structure associated, it's a mess. It's like a loss. There's only you have to be able to operate at volume. And if you can't, you're sunk, and you're seeing so many places go out of business, and that's only going to really benefit those who are well capitalized. So I've definitely got a lot to say about limited licenses versus just unlimited licenses and how that really truly affects a business. And so Illinois, I think, did it really well, where they limited the licenses and they're doing a strategic rollout so that pricing doesn't just drop through the roof or through the floor. And that has been really helpful. The ability for us to max out at 10 licenses, I think, is a good number. I mean, and if you look at the revenue that the OGs of the Illinois market, like the Cruscos and GTIs do, I mean, their lion's share is Illinois, right? And so we're really, really excited about what Illinois has to offer us. We do think obviously price compression is going to happen here, but it's going to happen at a slower rate because of the way that the regulatory structure was rolled out. So Massachusetts, difficult. Illinois, fun.
Is there any other states that you guys were looking at going into and just decided not to because it was just going to be too big of a regulatory headache?
You know, I think that in the past, we have looked at other states like Missouri, right? I mean, Missouri was one where we were just like, okay, are we going to go into this? Oklahoma, we looked at, and you're just like, I don't think that this is going to be good in the long term for us. And so we decided against those. But really now we are diving so deep into Illinois. That's the name of the game for us in 24.
It seems like that's going to be like the feeling amongst like the bigger tiered companies is that it's locking down the current assets and making sure to fortify the situation. Felt like the last year was like efficiency and everyone like getting the capital turned off. And now with maybe capital coming back, everyone's like, we're doubling down on our assets and we are building the protection. Just it seems like the industry's taken a really different approach. And now there's an aggressive understanding of like, this is what we're doing well. This is how we're going to excel.
Yeah, no, it is absolutely, that's what's happening. I think that although last year was tough from a capital standpoint, the reality is we got so much more efficient on all these things. So when the spigot turns back on, which it already has for us, I mean, we secured $10 million to go after some licenses in Illinois. When the spigot turns on fully though, the reality is we are going to be so much more profitable, you know, profitable, hopefully, right? I mean, with 280E, hopefully that really comes to fruition. But the reality is we've gained so much knowledge because we had to, right? Because there was no other way to operate but being efficient. And so, yeah, last year was how do you make it efficient? How do you do more with less? This year is going to be, for us especially, how do you strengthen the core assets that you have? And how do you make sure that when this all shakes out, you are extremely well positioned in the states that you think are going to be the best moving forward?
That was perfectly said. All right, so let's dive into your role because I'm fascinated by the title and then how you fit, because revenue to me can be on the internal side with all the COGS, or it can be kind of customer facing with understanding pushing at the margins. So where do you fit and is it both?
I've been in this role now for 7 months. I cut my teeth in retail operations. Obviously, I helped to open up the grows, but I was by no means a grower or really involved in how to maximize efficiencies at the grow. So I've been really trying to study that now. And it's both. The answer is both. It's really for me, and it's, you know, the revenue as a title is kind of, you know, there's a lot of responsibility that goes on to that. It's
pretty odd.
And you're damn right it is. And so the reality for me is I've been focusing my first six or 7 months now on external revenue, on how do I increase the revenue from a wholesale standpoint, which I think we did really well in 2023, especially in both states, in Massachusetts and Illinois. In Massachusetts, it wasn't 3x, but it was substantial in terms of wholesale increase. How do you increase revenue from a wholesale standpoint? How do you maintain and increase revenue from a retail standpoint, especially if you're not growing that retail footprint? How do you maintain revenue with falling prices? How do you speak to your customer base and understand your customer base and maintain them and then grow that, right? Because look, you're not all of a sudden going to get your average ticket from $60 to $100. What you're going to have to do is incrementally either stabilize that, find ways to increase it, but really you're going to have to find more bodies. You're going to have to get more people to understand who you are. You're going to have to differentiate yourself and have them understand why choose you over somebody else. And it definitely helps when you're vertically integrated, right? And you have the availability to have a wide breadth of products. And so the first half has been, how do you understand where can I maximize revenue? Yet, can we leverage our inside of the retail stores? Can we leverage that and start monetizing that with other wholesale partners? Do we even want to do that? And so asking myself those questions and being able to have answers that can be shown via a growth in revenue has been the name of the game so far.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And I think understanding the cultivation center, right? Because that is an expensive investment. But also for your standpoint, like if you're looking to accelerate revenue, you need opportunities internally in order to get to some of those projections. So squeezing out revenue of opportunities that others may not be aware of. Can you give us an example of a time where you did this or saw something and shared and said, hey, this is something where we can squeeze it out?
Yeah. So right now we're looking, and I just touched on this briefly, but we're opening up an additional dispensary right now we're a week away from construction on our third dispensary in Illinois. And then we've got a couple more subsequently after that. And when we were looking at how to lay this sales floor out and what to do in terms of, can you monetize the sales floor? You know, looking at the West Coast and seeing ways in which they've done it, and then looking at the Midwest and the East Coast and seeing ways in which they haven't done it. We said, okay, let's create this sales floor so that we have the availability to monetize specific areas for specific vendors in an effort to, and it doesn't have to be, hey, you're going to give us cash, but it could be, hey, you're going to offer us a product, a better discount of a product when we highlight your specific brands in this area. And so that's one of the ways that, at least top of mind, that's like one of the most recent things that we've done is, okay, how do you monetize this? How do you look to what you've seen in the states like Washington and other West Coast states? And how do you be at the forefront of that, pun intended, to really maximize the revenue that you're seeing out of the retail locations?
How much do margins have to do with specific product placement and all that? Is it one where you're like, hey, this product only has a 5% margin, it doesn't even go on the shelves, right? Like, is that a lot of the conversations that you guys have?
Yeah. And it's not even like it doesn't even go on the shelves. It's also like, how do you position that from an e-commerce standpoint too, right? I mean, 60% of our customers are ordering before they even get here. And if you have, your least profitable product that someone who's creating the menu really loves, you're going to shoot yourself in the foot, right? So it becomes a, how do you market this, not from just an inside the store standpoint, but from an external or e-commerce standpoint, so that really when someone is looking at your menu, you are showing them the products that are best from a margin standpoint and the products that you think actually will work given the specifics that you know, right? 70% when you combine flower and pre-roll, that's your biggest market. Why would you be putting tinctures at the top of your menu then? So it definitely has an effect on that. And that's when I talk about, maybe it's not about, hey, you're going to cut us a $10,000 check every month for this product placement. It's, hey, you're going to offer us a 20% discount on all of this specific flower brand or whatever it is, as long as we have this specific product placement for you guys.
Yeah, if not, you're on page 62 of that menu.
That's correct. You do not want to be on page 62 of a menu. You really don't.
The only person that's going there is that value shopper, like, searching.
Yep. So yep.
What is the most expensive lesson you've ever learned?
That's a great question. I think that and this kind of harkens back to what I was saying earlier about quality. We launched a brand in Illinois when we weren't ready. The product quality didn't meet what the brand's value proposition was, right? I mean, this is our high tier brand. We are going to put a high tier product in there. And we didn't exactly meet that, right? And that's an expensive mistake to make, because then all of a sudden you have to either pull that or you have to pause until you're ready to really go at it again. And so that's definitely one that's been very expensive. But I think the reality is, and I don't know if you were teeing me up for this or not, but I'm going to say it, is California. I mean, the California market was freaking tough, man. I mean, when prices for distillate fluctuate as they do in California, it's hard as hell to make a viable business out of that. And when you look to see it, like how these businesses are doing it, you scratch your head and you're like, how are they doing this? So that was a really expensive. I mean, thankfully, we were able to take a lot of our equipment and move it to Illinois. But there was a lot of time and brain power that went into California that we had to just essentially lose.
What's the biggest lesson you learned there, though, that you guys took to Illinois? Just the equipment? And
yes. So the equipment that we created in California, it was, I mean, we had like German scientists coming, you know, who speak only German. Like there were these guys, like we had to fine tune and calibrate products and machinery that took us a long time to really understand. And you have to be able to get the sizing right. You have to be able to wrap this thing correctly. And so that is something that takes time and takes a lot of effort and money. I mean, you just fly these German guys back and forth was real deal. And so the reality is that we can take that and apply it instantly into Illinois because of the effort that we put into California.
So that's a win.
Huge. That it really is. I mean, we're going to be able to create these products so efficiently and at scale. Everybody better be ready for us.
Dream smoking session, three people dead or alive.
Oh. Okay. So you know who I'd like to smoke with? Jesus.
All right.
That would be wild. That would be wild. He's got a lot to say. I would like to smoke with Bob Marley. I think that would be really transformational just to understand his ideas on Rastafarianism and just the culture in general. That would be huge. And then one third other person. I'd love to smoke with you guys.
Appreciate that. You can only choose one of us though.
Oh shit. Well, I guess East Coast it is.
Oh. Respectfully to Bob Marley, you said to be transformational to smoke with him, but not Jesus?
Oh, well, you know, Jesus is a given.
I just had to ask to clarify that because like you put transformational on Bob Marley and I was like, wow, Jesus. That's
how did you walk on water? How are you doing this?
Those are probably not a simple answer.
First thing is cup of water. We're going to need some wine.
Before I offer this.
Let's start with the first miracle first, please. Yeah, thank you.
You can
I will enjoy the story with my wine now.
It's pre-roll. If you could put anything on a billboard, metaphorically speaking, to get a message to billions of people, it could be an image, a quote, a word, or something that inspired you. What is the first thing that comes to mind?
I think naming your fears and leaning into those things is huge, right? I mean, because I deal with hundreds of employees on a daily basis, right? And my goal as a leader is to be able to get the best out of them, whether that's for us as a company, but mostly for themselves. And there are so many doubts in people's minds, and that doubt leads to fear. And if you can just name that fear, understand it, embrace it, and lean into it, you're going to be so much better and stronger as a person. I mean, it's a muscle, right? That you need to really be able to flex in order to get the best version of yourself. Because if not, you're limiting the only life that you have. And that is such it's such a gift we all have, right? And so to be able to, if I could remove doubt and fear from people and allow them to be the best versions of themselves, I think that this world would be an amazing place.
Very really well said. What question do you wish more people asked you?
I wish people really understood and asked me how cannabis really affects their body. You know, how cannabis reacts to your neurological system and how it binds to these receptors in your body. Because when you start to really dig deep into the understanding of what this product is, then you really understand how transformational, did it again, that it will be, right? I mean, because this product has, it's already, the acceptance rate is at like 80, 90% for medical, right? But when you start to really understand how it affects you, it starts to dispel the myth of, oh yeah, well, I'm okay with people getting a little high, and that, but it's not about, you know, just getting high. It's about understanding how it makes you well. So I wish people really started to dive deep into the science behind your endocannabinoid system and how that affects your body.
Well said.
All right, prediction time. Gabe, what emerging trends or market shifts do you anticipate will most significantly impact the cannabis industry in the next 2 years?
Shit, man. Well, 2 years, hopefully less than 2 years with the rescheduling. I think that there's a lot of quality debate on whether this should be a reschedule or a deschedule. But the fact of the matter is, we are talking about rescheduling, right? It can be descheduled at a different time to stop the train, to try to get this thing descheduled would be just doing a disservice to the years and years and effort that so many people put in to get us here. So I think that being able to have 280E go by the wayside will be huge. I think separately, which is not going to happen with rescheduling, is when publicly traded companies, and obviously this is for publicly traded companies, when we can uplist, that'll be huge, right? When we're able to list on major exchanges, when you're able to get institutional investments from major players, that's going to be really, really huge. Because when you look at the underlying financials of our companies, they're solid. They're so good. And if you understand and take multiples from other comparables and place them on the cannabis industry, we should be, you know, 3-4x where we are in terms of stock price. And so I think that that's going to be huge. That obviously gives us leverage to expand and gives us leverage to do a bunch of different things. So I think 280E is going to be huge. I don't have a crystal ball to know how it's going to be rolled out, but I hope it's done with states' rights in mind. And then being able to uplist will be another huge one as well.
Massive. Kellen?
I mean, I'm just going to piggyback on everything you said. I think rescheduling, the implications it has on 280E, as well as I think a lot of people think that the Safe Banking Act was like the save all for getting institutional funding, when in reality, a lot of the big banks do business internationally, right? And Safe Banking doesn't move the needle for their businesses in all these other countries. But rescheduling does have implications for like the National Narcotics Act. So that will allow institutions into the game more than they are right now, at least like publicly more than they are, right? Institutional funds. So I think those two catalysts are probably the most important for the entire industry. I mean, instantly give a bunch of people more money from 280E, and now you allow them to go access normal traditional business tools like capital equipment loans and these kind of things. I think it's an absolute game changer. What do you think, Brian?
Take a little different approach. I think what would be really awesome would be that since I shop here in New York, if I could understand what products are similar when I go to Chicago and visit Gabe's stores, or if I go to California or Washington, it'd be wonderful to know, like, you like these products in New York, your products similar to what you like. I think the ability to cross those state lines legally, right, and be able to understand which products kind of are what you're looking for would be really helpful as the industry starts to expand into outside of these state silos into a more, let's call it, global industry. I think that'd be something that'd be really interesting for me, because it's always like a guest test for buys, right? Like, sometimes I pick up a product that I love, other times it's a product that's okay. And I just wanted to know if there's a way to mitigate that, because there's endless choices in so many brands that it's hard to make those decisions when you do walk into a dispensary for the first time in another state and you're just not sure what to buy.
Yeah, and I think that the ability to deschedule or reschedule then deschedule will allow for more sophisticated technology to enter the space, will allow for a lot of the things that any other traditional retail or manufacturing company has that is so difficult to have right now. I mean, the people in the cannabis space on the tech side are trying their best, but the reality is they're still hamstrung by so many different, the same things that we are, they're hamstrung by, even if they're not plant touching. And so I am very excited about the ability to have technology advancements from a POS side, from an e-commerce side, from a customer segmentation side, from even like a customer communication side. That is going to be very, very huge. And I think that that's something I look forward to as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's wild when the terms of service say cannabis related businesses, because it's not even just cannabis business. It's now anybody in that circle next to the circle they've just deemed in that same bucket, which is just outrageous. And I'm talking about you, Stripe.
Yeah. Shout out to Stripe. Thank you.
Or not shout out Stripe. T-shout out Stripe.
Hey, what?
We're not shouting out, Kellen. So, Gabe, for our listeners, but to edit that out, Gabe, for our listeners, they want to get in touch and they want to check Forefront's products, where can they find you?
What I would recommend is our retail site is missiondispensaries.com. So if you're in the Massachusetts area, if you are in the Illinois or the Washington area, or I guess Washington would be cultivation, but Illinois and Massachusetts, please go to missiondispensaries.com. You get to see all of the different products that we offer. If you want to look at the company as a, from a parent company, go to forefrontventures.com. That's the number four, then frontventures.com. And it, yeah, I think that there is, there's a lot of really exciting things to come in Illinois, and we're continuing to innovate in Massachusetts, and we're bringing all of that from Washington. So please do keep an eye on us.
Awesome. We'll link it on the show notes. Thanks for taking the time. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks for your time.
Likewise. Take care, guys.
Guys, if you've enjoyed this podcast over the last few years, can you please take 3 minutes or less and leave us a quick review on Apple or Spotify? All reviews make a massive difference for us and help other people like you find this podcast. From the bottom of our hearts, thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Season 1 of Dope History is now available at dopehistory.com. Dope History weaves you through the lives of those who have been touched by cannabis or have had an influence on the events that shaped our laws or relationships with this plant. You'll hear tales from Frenchie Cannoli, Keith Strop, Eddie Lepp, Tom Alexander, Ed Rosenthal, Wolf Seagall, Jorge Cervantes, and Tommy Chong. Available now at dopehistory.com.